Hi and welcome to The Shepherd's Bag. I'm your host Maria Benjamin, and in this episode I'm talking to farmer Jenny Holden Wild. Jenny lives just a few miles up the road from me, but I recorded this episode ages before the lockdown, but I just hadn't had time to upload it. I'm really interested in how people farm, how they set up their business, so I hope you like this episode. Okay, so today I'm here with Jenny Holden Wild. Jenny farms not too far from me, and I'd just like to start by asking you, Jenny, do you come from a farming background?
No, I don't. Neither of my parents are farmers, but farming goes way back in my mother's family. So my mother's family were a family called the Turners, and we can trace them right back to the 10th century in the valleys, well, your valley, actually, and Oxon Park. There's a little field called Turnerfold Field. And then I believe the family farms got given away by Bonnie Prince Charlie. And my farming family had to move to the Duddon Valley. And in the Duddon Valley, you'll find farms like Turner Hall Farm, which is well known for being a campsite nowadays. But so no, I'm not from direct farming stock as such. My mum's cousin's farm. It must be somewhere in the genes.
Yeah, no, it sounds like it must be in your blood because you're quite a passionate farmer. When did you decide that you wanted to farm?
Well, I started helping on farms when I was 11. So I grew up in Backbarrow, which is a little village just down the road. And there was a female farmer in the village, which was quite nice. She was easy to get on with for me. Most people were terrified of her. but from the age of 11, I went fairly religiously every weekend, and I would be lambing sheep in the season before school and after school into the night. And I wouldn't bat an eyelid at getting up at 3:30 in the morning so that I can put in a lambing shift before school.
Wow. And your parents let you do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But because I was utterly animal obsessed from being really, really small. So from being a toddler, I was picking up bugs and learning about wildlife and crawling around with quite well-known naturalists like Chris Packham when I was about 9. So I'd got that background of being dedicated and getting up and just doing, and it was just what I wanted to do. And my parents trusted this farmer, and I had a great time. I learnt a huge number of skills.
Mm. So how old were you when you first lambed a sheep?
Oh, probably 12 or 13. I think, yeah. And they were chiviots, so they're not small. I remember one of my first days in the pen, one coming straight at me down the race, and Joan the farmer yelling, "Don't let that pass," and me trying to stop it and ending up actually on its back straddling it as it took off down the pen, and my feet weren't long enough to reach the floor. Oh, but you didn't cry if you got a knock or a bump. You just got up and got on with it.
And so why do you think Joan was scary to other people and not to you?
She should have been scary to me, but I just used to brush it off, which is funny because I'm a ridiculously sensitive soul with most people. But Joan was so matter of fact. And if you did something badly, you would get told off for it. But she wouldn't go on and on. It would just be, you did a, you know, don't want to swear on your podcast. But
it's all right, you can swear.
Fuck's sake, Jenny. But that would be the end of it.
Yeah.
And I always worked really hard to put it right when I did get something wrong. So if you let all the sheep out, you would get sworn at.
Mm.
But I would run round until we got them all back in again. So
yeah. At least you know where you stand with someone who's straightforward like that.
I think that was it. And I was so keen that I didn't care that I was getting told off. Mm. It was one of those where nothing was going to put me off being out with the livestock. Not even the day when I realised, when I was 13, I realised I realised, obviously I already knew, but it really hit home that these animals I was raising are going on people's plates.
Yeah.
And I remember having a really hard conversation with myself, because I got to the farm one day and I'd been in charge of looking after the wether lambs,
mm-hmm.
which were going off to market, of course. But and I knew that they were being raised for market. But when I got to the farm one day and they'd just gone, and I said, oh, where are my lambs? And I just got, well, the market day yesterday, Jenny, they've all gone, haven't they? And I sort of bit my lip and went, oh, right. And then I thought, well, I've loved and looked after these animals and I can either deal with this or I can't. But I really had that conversation with myself where I said, if you're not going to be able to cope with this, Jenny, you need to stop eating meat, because it's just hypocritical of you to raise animals and not be able to bear the killing bit of them. And also, you'll have to stop coming to the farm. And I think as I got a bit older, I had that conversation with myself, I decided that I could deal with that. But actually, what really made me happy in the fact that and really accepting of my place in the ecosystem, that I was an omnivore, and that's what I was, and that's what in evolutionary terms humans are, and that's what I am as an animal. It was really when I did my biology degree and I was studying wild animals,
mm-hmm.
and I was watching the way that they behave towards each other and the interactions between them all, and I just came to this understanding of that is the way that ecosystems function.
Yeah.
And all animals suffer. Doesn't matter whether they are whether they're predators, whether they're prey. Being alive, being a wild animal is hard and stressful, and at some point you're going to suffer. And I looked at the way that I kept farm animals, the way that I worked with farm animals, and obviously there are bad farmers, just as there are bad pet owners and bad parents and all sorts out there. And I thought, well, actually, these animals that I'm raising for meat, they have no worries, really. In the grand scheme of things, they're provided for. They've always got food. They've always got shelter. If they get ill, I'll treat them. If they're getting parasites, generally I spot that before they even start suffering with them, and I treat them and they're looked after. And at the end of the day, when it comes to when it does come to the day that they die, yes, I decide that day, and some people don't agree with that. But on the other hand, it's a short trip down the road. They're so not stressed by it that they go into the pen at the abattoir and they immediately start eating. Or when I take the boys, they start trying to hump whatever's next door. And I know that the death is swift because I've watched it. And I think compared to what I see wild animals going through, I think, actually, that's not a bad life.
So when did you stop working with Joan, was it?
Yeah, with Joan. It was really sort of when I went to uni. But I got to 16 and started needing to earn a bit more money.
Yeah.
And so I took on extra work, which didn't go down terribly well. But it was really going off to university, and things changed and Joan moved away, and that was kind of the end of that. But in the meantime, I'd also been getting to know some other farmers and helping out with other people's livestock as well. And when I was 13, I was still very much helping Joan right through, but I started showing rare breeds for another farmer when I was 13 and got interested in, and that's where the love of Shetlands came from, really.
Right.
And the farmer that I worked with kept lots of different rare breeds. Everything from Bulwins through to Tamworth pigs and all sorts of things. But for some reason, the Shetland sheep really, really ingrained themselves into a little corner. They're such characters, and they're so colourful. And so when I finally got to the stage of being able to have my own flock, when I was 25, I would have been 25, and I'd got rid of my livestock-hating boyfriend and got one that liked animals, I was in a position where I knew people with land that they needed grazing but didn't want to keep their own livestock at the time, so I took the opportunity to to start up my own flock. And that's where Smaley Shetlands was born, as Smaley's the Old Norse word for sheep. So I thought it was fitting for an Old Norse breed. And I travelled far and wide gathering those founder stock. They were really, really important.
What were you looking for in your starter flock?
I wanted a range of different colours and patterns, which is kind of the novice Shetland breeders' first go-to. Is I want them to be as colourful as possible. But it's nice to be able to recognise them all. I particularly wanted some grey sheep. I really liked grey Shetlands. But they needed to be hardy, proper little hill sheep, really. Mm-hmm. I did want to do some showing, which I've gone on to do. But more important was that they could survive on conservation grazing. And I quickly learnt that a Shetland isn't just a Shetland and they don't all do what it says on the tin. And so building up the flock that I've got now of around about 100 very hardy Shetlands has been quite a long game and a game of trial and error.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it is a long game actually. And it's not that you can just buy sheep and they will respond positively to the land that you put them on.
No.
And so it's, you know, some just don't do well in it at all and for no real reason that you can work out. So yeah. It does take time. But I mean, that's and has your grazing changed much over that period?
My sheep, bless them, have been everywhere.
Because
I worked in conservation when I got them, and conservation jobs typically only have so long a time span when you're going to be in one place. So the sheep started off when I worked at Cumbria Wildlife Trust. Mm-hmm. They moved with me all the way to Argyll when I was releasing beavers in Argyll. Mm-hmm. Then they moved back down with me and they were on ryegrass fields in Furness, which mm-hmm. they didn't like very much. They didn't do terribly well on the lush green ryegrass fields, but they were there while I was doing some consultancy work. But then I also took on some conservation grazing, managing triple SIs for species like natterjack toad. And then now they're quite settled now. They're on a very old-fashioned farm, nestled near Cartmel, and they're on very herb-rich grassland. And they look so well.
Yeah, they do. I've seen them on that grassland and they do look so fit. Like it just suits them, that particular...
It really does. I think that
bit of ground.
Big diversity of different species that are in there. And it supports so much wildlife.
Yeah.
And it hasn't been fertilised for over 60 years.
Amazing.
And you just walk into that field and when you walk through the marshy section at the bottom, you just get clouds of dragonflies coming up from there. And then up on the grassland, the chimney sweeper moths have just come out and the various different skippers have just come out, and the small pearl-bordered fritillaries were there this week, and it's looking really beautiful out there.
Fantastic. And is that private grazing, or is that for a conservation trust?
This is private grazing.
Right.
Yeah, it's private grazing. So the farmer, she's been there since her 20s.
Right.
And she and her husband bought it when they were in the 20s and quite newly married. And when they moved in, there was no running water, no electricity, certainly no phone line. And they had a small number of milking cows and she milked them all by hand twice a day.
Wow.
I know.
God.
And
is she retired? Is that why you've got the land?
She's semi-retired.
Oh, right. So she's still...
I don't think she thanked me for mentioning her age, but she's getting on in years. If you think that she moved on there in her 20s and she's been there 60 years.
Yeah.
So... she gets on her quad bike every day and she goes and feeds her and checks her herd of red deer, because she has a small herd of animals that she farms. She's still got sheep on the land, and she's just in partnership with one of the neighbours, just bought some more cows.
No. Oh, my God.
There are two beautiful red poles on there, and an Angus, and I should know what they all are. I can't remember now. But, nice little bunch of cows that she's going to bring on and get some homegrown beef. So she's busy, but she can't manage as big a flock. and
yeah,
not.
yeah,
So,
yeah.
so yeah, so I've got a couple of fields.
Brilliant. Yeah. And so have you, so you don't have a farm because your family don't have a farm. Have you
No.
been trying to get a farm, or what's your sort of plan with the livestock?
Yeah, so we, my husband and I, that is, we applied for a few National Trust farms, and always got interviews, always got down to the last few, and got told that they wanted to give us a farm, but not this farm. And I'd given up because my husband really isn't well, and right. he hasn't been well for 12 years now. And so, and now he's ill in other ways as well. So we were kind of giving up on it. And then there might possibly be a little opportunity on the horizon. Well, there are two opportunities, actually. Mm-hmm. One is that the cottage on the farm where we have the sheep is coming up for rent.
Right.
So we could move on and be able to see the sheep out of our window
yeah,
for the first
time
in our lives.
Mm.
The other thing is that a few farms have just come up with the National Trust again, mm-hmm. including one that we very nearly got last time. And it's one of my family's old family farms in the Duddon Valley.
Oh, wow.
So the temptation to apply for it again is quite high.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic.
But we'll see. I don't know. It depends whether I've got the energy to drag husband and small child, who's now in tow, through that journey. So we'll see.
Mm. Yeah, and so you studied biology, so you've always been, so when did this sort of an interest in conservation from a really young age, and that's never left you?
No, it's never gone away. I've been teaching biology now for the last 7 years.
Mm.
Because when we decided to start a family, we needed to settle, and my conservation work, the hours are all over the place, the contracts can be all over the place. And so we moved back down to Cumbria for a bit and sort of started to grow roots. And the local college asked me whether I would just come along part-time and teach environmental science for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's grown into a full-time job where I'm course leader for the BTEC Applied Science. So I've been doing that for a while now, but... We still kept up. We've had a consultancy on the side the whole time as well.
Right.
So I've been still doing some ecological consultancy work.
Mm.
And who knows what the future holds in terms of work. I might go back into conservation again.
Mm. What else did I want to ask you about? I think I was interested in how it is. I'm always interested in how it is as a woman farmer. Because it's really you running your farm business. I know your husband likes the animals, but when I've seen you out, they're your animals. You're the one that's in charge. You're managing them. It's your business.
It's my baby.
Yeah.
Yeah. The flock's absolutely 100% my baby, really. And Chris is a really, really good help sometimes. And enjoys... eating the meat apart from anything. And he does enjoy being out and checking them, but as much so he can take pictures of the wildlife as anything else.
Mm.
Especially as a very young woman, you know, when you think, I'm getting so old now, you know, when you go back to my first visits to the auction marts,
mm-hmm.
and the farm suppliers and that sort of thing, and we're talking about going back to the mid-90s.
Mm.
And yes, there were other female farmers, but men still automatically turned to the man as being, and you would constantly be told that, don't you try and do that, lass, I'll do it. And there was a real lot of proving myself. And I wasn't from a farming background either. And although I did have a Cumbrian accent, which I've lost a lot of, actually, because I lived in London for a while, et cetera, but when I am with the farmers, I can talk Cumbrian with the best of them. But I went into a world when I was 11 where, and that was in 1992, where I didn't know what a wether and a gimmer and all the rest, I didn't know what cowped a Kessin meant, and I didn't even call something a female sheep a yow. It was a it was a ewe, I'd always been told, and a ram, not a tup. Yeah. And I had a whole new language to learn. And I found that the faster I picked up that language, the more respect I got. So, and it's been quite amusing as a conservationist as well, because of course traditionally farmers hate us a lot of the time. And I must confess, I have played the female card on an odd occasion, because we tend to be quite well trusted as well, or at least thought that perhaps we're meaning less damage sometimes, which is terribly stereotypical, but it's just it's just the way that I found. And so I have been known to smile sweetly at a farmer to get access to the land so that I can do the wildlife surveying that I need to do. But also, if I just turn up as an ecologist, but then the conversations can quite swiftly turn hostile in those situations, because the farmers do not want you on their land quite often, and you're asking to gain access to often to prove that something really rare lives there, and they don't want anyone else to know that something really rare lives there. But if you flip the conversation round by being able to use the same language and refer to the farmer's stock and start asking him about his livestock, they very, very quickly come round. And being able to speak the same language as the farmers and being able to speak the same lingo as the the locals has opened a huge number of doors for me and allowed me to make some progress where things were really floundering. And I remember in Scotland when we were doing the beaver release, and that, you know, you can imagine the conflict that went on there. And one of the local farmers turned round to me and went and said, "You're the only bloody conservationist I've ever met who talks any bloody sense at all." And it was based on really nothing other than the fact that I understood where he was coming from.
Yeah.
And I could be a bit more pragmatic about and honest about. That's the most important thing, really, is just being honest about.
But I think, yeah, also being able to see it from another perspective. And I think that's important in every all of these sort of situations where it's them against us, like you were saying about the sort of vegan issue. I can understand why they want to protect animals and all of that sort of stuff. But at the same time, I can absolutely see from a farmer's point of view how painful it is to be told that you don't care about your animals and stuff. And as I guess in your work as a conservationist, understanding how important farm animals, livestock are for the farmers, and that's what that's their business.
Yeah.
Then how to approach a subject where, you know, they don't want to see anything that impacts negatively on their business. So.
But equally, I have found that while farmers do habitually put large numbers of stock on, especially those who've lived through the periods of headage payments.
Yeah.
And it's been quite interesting because we don't have headage payments, of course, anymore, but people quite frequently still stock to that.
Overstock, or stock to that level,
Stock to that level or habitually overstock. And partly because it's so easy to do. It's very easy to overstock land. But the things that we've done to try and mitigate against overstocking so far haven't really worked in my mind, at least.
What are the things?
Well, we changed the schemes, we changed the payments so that, you know, you no longer got paid per head. You got paid for delivering certain environmental services, basically. It hasn't worked out the way that we hoped. So foot and mouth disease, and trust me, I was devastated by foot and mouth disease. I was living in London at the time and watching the news and getting emails from my friends about what was happening, and friends lost their entire flocks, and I used to sit and watch the news in tears. So I'm not taking away from how devastating that was, but the years following foot and mouth were the first time I'd ever seen the fells go truly purple with heather. And it was the first time in certain locations we saw some of the vegetation making a comeback. And I really thought that and actually I had some conversations with farmers as well where they said, oh, the stock have never looked so fit because they, you know, they've got space and da 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 da, and they were kind of motivated not to stock back up to the same level.
Yeah.
But they ended up doing it.
Creeping in, getting more. It
crept up and crept up and crept up until we're at the stage again where the fells have had too many stock on them. Mm. And
they're quite controlled though, aren't they? By, I mean, I know John, he has cows and sheep up on the fell. And Natural England are really quite strict about numbers.
It depends on the designations
right.
on each particular site and what schemes you're in as well. And the fells actually aren't as bad as they were. I should be really referring to the lower ground because you end up just having to feed. And feed and feed. Which is what a lot of people habitually do. Is just
feed plow. Because it's which seems a bit of a waste. But apparently I think John said the hedgerows were incredible as well, and that was more to do with vehicles.
Said
that was amazing. Like suddenly where did all this wildlife come from? It's like it's waiting for us to bugger off. And then it'll come back.
Yeah, but it's a question of, you know, things will only put up with so much for so long.
Yeah.
So while we've still got those seed banks there, and we've still got some things have managed to tick over, and you've got some wildlife in little pockets. But the trouble is, those pockets just get smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
Until things actually vanish.
Mm.
And with the best will in the world, once they've vanished.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. So we need to. Luckily, there really is a. There's an appetite for change now, I think.
Yeah.
With David Attenborough having done his wonders on single-use plastics, and people are wanting to see and make the changes, I think, but a lot of there's a lot of denial. In farming, like I'll talk to when I was working managing farm conservation projects when I was a few years out of university, there was a lot of denial that anything had changed on the farms.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really interesting because you would talk to the farmers and they'd go, well, I don't know where all this wildlife's gone. It's not my fault. Nothing to do with our farming methods. Our farming methods haven't changed in 50, 60 years. And that was frequently what they would quote, this 50-year thing. They would tell me that nothing's changed here in 50 years. And you'd be going, really? You were giving ivermectin 50 years ago regularly? You were fluking them every 6 weeks or whatever it had got to? You were growing silage crops instead of hay 50, 60 years ago? Oh, they weren't.
Mm.
Lots of things have changed on farms. We weren't putting the same. We weren't using porons. We were still dipping.
Mm.
And a lot of these things, I think we're going to have a realization very, very shortly that. And bearing in mind that I fluke and wet my sheep, right? But I think we're going to have this big realization soon that actually these drugs that we're giving our sheep and our cattle and are being pooed out into the ground are causing absolute mayhem with our invertebrates.
Yeah.
And that is really scary. I mean, I've pretty much stopped using as far as I can and I've started keeping the sheep off for a couple of days, ideally 72 hours before they go back onto the land after being fluked or wormed.
Right.
I'm not fluking and worming the whole cohort.
So you bring them in and if you fluke and worm them, keep them in until you can put them out. But what do you do with the poo that's inside then?
I sweep it up and put it on a muck heap away from a watercourse.
Right.
So it's still there.
Uh-huh.
But hopefully the heat and the breakdown of the muck in the muck heap is also accelerating the breakdown of those chemicals as well.
Interesting.
But if you drive around, have a look at your number plate.
Mm-hmm.
Have a look at your license plate if you can, see how many squash bugs there are on it.
No, I do remember like the squash bugs on the front of our car as a kid.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, you'd have to, you know, really wash the windscreen as well.
Yeah.
so many insects on it, and there just isn't now.
No. And scarily, you see more in arable areas where we're really worried about them using. I mean, it's still nothing like it used to be.
Yeah.
But you see more in arable areas, like when I visit friends in Norfolk, than you do driving around pastoral areas.
Mm.
And I think that's probably quite telling. Yeah. There's also some research that's come off Shetland and off the outlying islands where they really haven't changed their farming practices in terms of numbers of stock or types of stock or types of crops that are grown. The only thing that they've started doing is worming the ponies.
Right.
The pony herds with ivermectin. Uh-huh. And it's causing, it seems to be, correlation doesn't always equal causation, Jenny.
Yeah.
But it seems to be a direct link to declines of beetle species there.
Right, so that's quite a big one. That's a change. So when I think I asked earlier on, what do you think farmers should do? That's one thing that they could do.
Yeah, I think
bring their animals in. If you do want to fluke and worm them,
yeah,
bring them in 72 hours.
I know, it's expensive and it's difficult. You know, you imagine being a hill farmer, which you are. Sorry about that. So if you think about, you know, if you got all your civets down.
Yeah, that is a lot.
That's a lot. It might be that it has to be that you've got one field or something that you kind of sacrifice a bit and you say, well, we're not going to put them all back up on the fell.
Yeah.
We're going to keep them in this one field or something.
Yeah.
Even if you can only manage 24 or 48 hours, at least they'll have pooed a lot of that chemical out again before they go back up on the fell. I think that a return to hay cropping would be a positive move over silage. And I think that ploughing up and reseeding is, to be honest, is a horrendous thing to do.
Who does that?
You get shot for that. Oh, it's really common once you go a little bit further away from here.
I mean, I guess it's too rocky here.
It's too rocky, so people don't. But you go just, you know, 5 miles down the road and you start finding that people, quite regularly plough up the fields, roll it, reseed it with ryegrass and clover and produce a much, much more vigorous growing crop. But there's no diversity in it and you've just damaged that soil structure.
Yeah.
And it's being done over and over and over again. Yeah. And then really anywhere where you can return to traditional methods, so thinking about cross-grazing to reduce your pesticide, your anthelmintic use, and rotational use of ground again. There was a lot of wisdom in that.
Yeah, there was, in the small paddocks, so you would be moving them into these.
But of course our machinery isn't set up anymore for small
paddocks. I know. So all those walls were taken down to make big fields, and that's what it was all about. But yeah, it's true. But it was interesting, I went to that ethical farming conference in Scotland, and there was the one debate about... one method of farming, which is the a bit like mob grazing, where you've got them in a contained space for a small amount of time, and then you move them on, so they're only just chomping once on the grass, and then they're moving. But then on the other side of that, so they're in, you know, they're in quite a tight space, and you can't really do it with like ewes and lambs, you know, it's just not really. So anyway, I guess you would probably have to just use your sterks or something or your wethers. But then, somebody else was talking about animal welfare, and really to be thinking always about animal welfare is, does that animal have choice in how they, in their area of where they are? Okay. You know, can they make decisions, you know, can they just decide, oh, I'll go over there and chomp on that thing? So if they're in a really small area, they don't really have.
Yeah, I've really mixed feelings about mob grazing, and I've seen some really good, exciting stuff about it, and then some conflicting evidence to say that actually it might not be the best method to use necessarily. And I think it's been modelled on... places like the plains of Africa on the assumption that, you know, the stock are only on there for a short period of time.
Yeah.
But actually the time it takes for an entire herd of wildebeest and zebra to move across that land, we can't really replicate that.
And it's such a different environment. It's so brittle there. It's so different to, like, it's at some point, you know, at some times of the year, you know, it would just be a mud bath within mm-hmm. half an hour. So then, you know, it's just destroyed that ground as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So it's how to make a system work for that's good for the animals. It works in our environment, which mm-hmm. is very changeable, and is easier on the farmer because, like, moving livestock every day when you've got so much to do as well.
Yeah.
To be constantly moving these and making sure they've got water in all these little areas.
Well, that's a huge problem.
Yeah.
Is making sure they've always got enough water. I think a lot of it comes down to what breed you choose and stocking density as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
Because if anything, I'm slightly understocked at the moment. Mm. But that said, you know, I can close gates off and shut them into a slightly smaller area. My only problem is that then the other bit gets away, and if the grass gets away too much, then it's choking out the flowers underneath.
Yeah, and the sheep tend to prefer it, but
yeah,
maybe the sheep, cows or something as well.
But. Yeah, that's what I need. Yeah, I need cows.
You need cows.
Put some cows in. Yeah. It's such a huge, complex picture, and it's not going to be the same on every farm.
Each farm is so unique and different, and the people are different as well, and it's not like a one system fits
and breeds
all
behave very differently. You know, my Shetlands don't behave in the same way that, you know, the Cheviots that I started off farming do. They're different beasts.
Yeah. Okay, I think we should... finished there. It's been so nice to talk to you.
And you, as always.
Yeah, lovely. Thanks a lot, Jenny.
All right, thank you for the invite.
Many thanks to Jenny Holdenwell for joining me today. It's always great to hear about how people got started in their farming life, and I love learning about different farming systems and ways of doing things. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode as well. Thank you.